can you settle down so that we can get down to Kuzma? Okay, I already had the following hints. Let me see, Mr. Fabs, Mr. Singh, Mr. Munguni, in that order. But I had already recognized Mr. Asiya in his first set of issues, which was coupling.
Yeah, that's okay. Thank you, Chair. One should also like to commend the agent with the audited report and following the prescribed of the law. I think that you must not be found fighting when people are on the wrong side, even if when they are on the right side, you must commend it. Yeah. Jefferson, the question in terms of the accumulated surplus. When you look at about 2006 financial year, it was 555 budget, but it's not significant in terms of the funding. But the question is, I've got a concern. In 2007, it is rising. Is it going to, I mean, not surplus the liabilities? Well, does it suggest to mean that when the year goes up, is it going to accumulate and accumulate up to when? The liabilities, you see. Then that's my concern in terms of your funding. But as I said earlier on, it's not that significant. But I think that it has to stop somewhere. The other one, Chairperson, when we were briefed here about the short-term insurance...
Mr. Sebi, you want to refer specifically to the page in the financial statement?
Page 50, Chair.
Page 50. Oh.
Yeah. Liability.
Okay.
Yeah. So, the other issue is that when we... the slides, they don't have numbers, and I think my pages were... their numbers are not clear, even if I put my spectacles. But nonetheless, we're informed about the short-term insurers if they are the culprit. There are the people who are giving people some problems and they don't give right information and so on. And it was alluded that even people who are in the industry, they don't understand who are the role players. My question is what is your suggestion other than complaining and telling us about it? What do you bring as a recommendation? What this committee can be able to assist you if you cannot try to resolve that problem, because it is dealing with the majority of the people within the industry. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Ms. Fox?
Thank you, Chairperson. The highly enthusiastic team at FICE and quite illuminating some of the information we've received for a young organization seems to be in the right direction. Chairperson, nevertheless, I just wondered, there was a recognition about the need for consumer awareness and so on, but unless I can't read these statements very clearly, I can't find the figure for all this training that you've indicated should be, you know, that you do need consumer awareness. Where do you locate the funds for this? Do you locate any funds? Allocate any, number one. There was another point being made, and unfortunately, Chair, I can't find it in the book at the moment. about mobilizing the media, who should be also contributing to this consumer awareness. Is this on the understanding of a kind of broad societal thrust? You're not thinking of allocating them funds to do this, or were you thinking of paying for certain advertising or slots? The other point on page 60, gifts, nearly R1 million. I try to figure out if I'd ever benefited from one of these gifts. I hope not. 915,000. Is that correct on page 60? Is it? Or is it more than that? Is it? Is it 915? A million? What is it? Is it 1,000? Sorry, no, yeah. All right, R1,000. Is that what it's looking like? Well, all right. Well, they're very little, I suppose. That must have been just a stud or two. All right. The entertainment expenses, those entertainment expenses there. Now, that is just for the organization. It's very low, so I suppose one ought to leave that one alone. The loans and receivables on page 54, which are being referred to as trade receivables in the bank balance sheet on page 50, is that right? That's right, that figure there. Trade and receivables. The first note is financial assets there, note to the financial statement. Loans and receivables are classified as trade receivables in the balance sheet. All right. And then on page 50, that would appear to be the balance sheet. And then trade and receivables. And then I think we're definitely looking at the millions there, 200 odd million, is that right? So, are you in thousands here? You're not in millions. I'm so used to looking at billions and millions that you're closer to my own bank balance. Not quite.
There are another sort of income that we don't know about.
No, the point is, I didn't say if it was which side. That's the thing. That's why I'm being looked after so well by my bank manager. But the point I want to make, really, now I earn an awful lot of money, but unfortunately it's keeping me in good health. The point I really want to make, though, in this area is I would certainly like to have seen more of a consumer awareness in places. I know that you've read out different concerns on the short term and so on the pensions and that kind of thing, but it could well be because most people do not know about you. This is what I'm getting at. And the second thing is on the type of claim being made and so on the short term, the reference to vehicles seem to preoccupy the situation, although I know that that's not the only thing. It's other aspects as well. And a final comment from you would be welcome, because there seem to be a lot of emphasis and enthusiasm and the kind of justification or validation, as it were, motivation for a single ombudsman. I certainly have heard what you've had to say. And then presumably you saw yourself as that single ombudsman. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. Firstly, thank the team for a wonderful presentation. Very interesting one. At least we laughed in Finance Committee after a long time. Otherwise, we're very serious about things.
What are you saying about the committee?
Firstly, just to share your concern about the jurisdiction confusion or jurisdiction conundrum. I think this is a matter of serious concern and should be for us as a committee. Where we're hearing from an organ here that things are not all right on the coast of Denmark. And possibly we have the responsibility as the Finance Committee to bring together all the ombudspersons and sit them down and lock them away for a few days with us and let them talk to each other across the table and come out with a way of possibly having a single point of entry where anybody can complain about anything. And from there, that body must reroute the complaint, whether it's to the short-term industry ombudsperson or the vice ombudsperson, whoever. And then there must be a way of also going back to see if those complaints have been attended to. Maybe something like that. But just to start where Ms. Buff finished off on the financial statements, on page 60, I just note, but maybe, I'm sure there's a good reason, on audit fees and accounting fees, I see there's nothing shown as accounting fees for 2007. I don't know if it's put under audit fees, because there's quite almost a 60% increase there, from 242 to 383. And then if one looks at cellular phone costs, cleaning and general maintenance, and consulting fees, I also see some very large increases in that regard. If one looks on page 57, at item 7, operating expenses, and then the leases, if the team here can just give us an idea on these leases, because I see some of them are later than 1 year, but not later than 5 years, and they go right up to 3 million, you know, whether they're still occupying those buildings and things like that, and whether there's going to be no loss. But, Chair, just to come to other general things, Ms. Baum spoke quite a lot about the short-term insurance and vehicles. Now, I don't know where insurance on buildings, bondholders insurance fits in. Is it long-term, medium-term, or whatever? Because there one gets the sense that, you know, you have a home that the bondholder will value at 5 or 6 million rand. And when you go to the bank for a loan, they say your house is 1 million. And when you query it with the bondholder, they say, no, but that's the replacement value. Now, people just become, captured. You know, you just become victim. You want a bond, and you just become a victim to the bondholder, like on a short-term insurance, you want to drive your car out of the showroom. And then there's this huge discrepancies in these values. Right. That's just the one thing I need some kind of a comment on. Secondly is the question of identity numbers, use of ID numbers. You know, I'm an example. I applied for a telephone the other day in my private name, and they turned me down because they said I owe Telkom money since 2000, or 10 or 12,000 rand. And I said, well, I don't owe Telkom a cent. They said, but we've got your ID number. You've got two telephones in Sanga. I don't live in Sanga. I live on the South Coast, right? But somebody used my ID number, which is publicly available. All our ID numbers are publicly available. They use your ID number, they apply for something, and whenever you apply for credit now, you are identified by your identity number. Now, I don't know if you've got any comment in that regard. And then you get listed, and to get delisted with this new credit act here is such a schlep that sometimes you just forget about it and say, let me not buy on credit in future. So we just need to see whether or not, you know, you have any comment on that. Then the last one for now, Jay, is on the consumer education. And when I was looking at the last page, and you list some of the groups that you've interacted with, I'm not surprised that KwaZulu-Natal doesn't feature high in terms of how many complaints you get. Because a radio station like Ukhozi, which reaches 10, 12 million people, doesn't feature there. So I think the regional broadcasters, particularly radio, because you see a lot of people are illiterate, and you've said that earlier on, you've got to use the regional broadcasters. And there are a number of community radio stations as well that are springing up all over. And I think that has to be a source of, useful for communication. And then the last question, the very last is, how do you prioritize dealing with the complaints that you receive? I mean, we've got some very interesting cases here. Would you take the bigger ones? Would you take one that you received from Mr. Kumalo in Nongoma? Even though the amount is small, but the person has been ripped off. How do you prioritize? Because I don't think you have enough staff to be able to deal, you know, with these complaints within the time. Thank you. I'll stop there for now, Chair.
Okay. just perhaps take responses to these questions and then I'll take the next question.
Chair, may I just start and deal with one issue which I think has come across from a number of the questions, including yours, around consumer engaging with consumers, engaging with the stakeholders, the industry. To start with, if you look at the Fines Act, Section 32 clearly states that the registrar of the Financial Services Board has the function of consumer education. It is not a function of the Fines Ombuds, although the Fines Ombuds will work in conjunction with the registrar when requested from time to time. That obviously has budgetary implications, which means that there is no budget item which says, this is your budget for consumer education. So that's the one restrictive factor. We are, I think the intention behind the Act was to say, this is an office created specifically to deal with the issues of complaints as they come in, so let it be there to deal with it. Now, we report to a committee of the Financial Services Board. It's a board committee. We have had occasion to go and ask for funding relating to specific areas where we said, for example, we want to put advertorials in the City Press and the report, which has a magazine called Health and Health Saka and Money Matters. That has been a regular kind of feature for which we've had to seek specific consent. The consumer education in which we engage is ad hoc. It is done out of our own spirit and awareness that consumers need to know about our office, that consumers need to know from the horse's mouth, as it were, what it is that we do. And this is the way in which we do the engagement, the various engagements. Now, in respect of the insurance bodies, broker bodies that appears on the last back cover, we engage with them to tell them how they could do best practice. For example, I arrived here yesterday and spoke at a function for all mutual top achievers, telling them what best practice is, telling them how to treat their consumers fairly. And that I do on a consistent basis. And it's not, if I may put it bluntly, it's not really part of the functionality, if you understand how the Act has been framed. Now, that is the way in which we do it. When we issue a judgment or there is a need for us to engage with the media, and that's where the Kaya FM talk radio, RSG, etc. comes in, you'd find that the radio stations would phone you and then you'd say, yeah, I'm willing to talk. But this is in addition to your core function, which is the resolution of complaints and the adjudication and investigation of complaints, which I think we've got to understand is where we're sitting at currently. We'd love to have a whole wing dedicated to consumer education and consumer awareness. In fact, that is a passion of mine because it is something that says you must talk to the people so that they can understand what you do and you must talk to the industry so that it could improve its practices. So it's within those constraints that we relate whenever we do with consumers and other stakeholders. I don't know if my colleagues would have anything more on the issue of consumer education. I think we've covered that. On the question of turnaround time, which is the second question you put to us, Chair, I think Eugene Oakes and Ms. Bunn will take that in turns so that they could cover it as best they could.
Honourable Chair and members, regarding the turnaround time, that's actually one of those we normally call a tamaleki. We're sitting with capacity increase of 100% last year. The demand actually increased by 100%. I think we actually underestimated the growth of the office within that 1 year. It's a 100% jump. We expect now a 157% increase this coming year. We have already sent out positions available for people to come and come work at the office. But of course, we're also sitting with the following. You're sitting with people that are specialists. They need to have training, etc. So I don't want to make excuses. The reality is most probably it will take more. We wanted to focus on 6 months. that was our focus. That's the perfect model. The reality is that it's not that turnout on farm at the current moment. Let me just put it in perspective. If we take the 860 complaints carried over from the previous financial year to this coming financial year, we sat with five case managers. Five case managers investigating 860 investigations. What you're doing is 860 investigations for five people. Because what happened is some people left, come back, and so we replaced people, but people also left. We're employing an additional six. If we continue with it, we are currently working on a model, getting a break-even point of what we expect the amount of complaints each and every case manager needs to handle. So we're working on approximately around about 50 to 60, but now if we look around about that, you're sitting with the following budget constraints. So in a perfect world, we can get 40 case managers or 50 case managers, but the capacity or getting the budget to fund it, that's one of the biggest issues. I think the child concern was also in the beginning, because in the beginning we didn't really have a history to work on. Because we were in the first year with 600, we could have handled it. Second year was just a bit of an increase to 1,000, I think, complaints. And now this financial year, that's the justiciable complaints is over 1,000. So that actually, now we've got a basis to work from, to do some forecasting and to see if we can get some other point of break even. Now what we can also do is combat this, of course, by training. We will have to increase our budget towards that, and we're also going to have an in-house department focusing on training and development of the new employees, and on a continuous basis to be in communication with the external parties involved. That will be all the financial services providers, because you'll find I can also come from the financial industry, and I most probably was the enemy of the state, as they would label me. I was also a broker at the time. Yes. So what I want to say is it's very important is because it's continuous change, we will have to have a database of all products launched in South Africa, financial products, and all the employees will have to be updated, or we'll have to have some other knowledge center where people, because it's very difficult to know all the products. We're not just covering short-term or just investment or just banking or just, we're doing everything. And because of that, we're sitting with a problem that you've only got that capacity in your mind, and it can be sometimes very challenging. So the office realizes we've got a challenge. I think the turnaround time now, to be honest, I don't want to tell you stories. The reality is I think it will be around about over a year just to have a turnaround time. We're sitting with people with maybe 200 investigations, 250 investigations on their desk. That's the problem, but we're addressing it. That's what we're working towards. We're employing, we're training. And from that point onwards, we will have to budget for, get all the figures together and budget for it. But you know how the world is out there. It works on the principle of budget. Now, if there wasn't a budget, I can tell you now, we most probably would have had an office the size of Parliament to deal with all the complaints. If you think about it, every time when we do determination, we're marketing ourselves because it comes in the newspaper. Truth bot, at the end of the week, you'll find an increased spike of 20 to 30% in complaints just because of that one thing in the newspaper. So what I'm trying to say is it's a really difficult environment, and I understand the concern, and we're also concerned about it, but we're working towards it. And finally, the last thing that I want to say is, for instance, you're worried about the complaint volumes. What do you think the complaint volumes are in the UK? It's over 100 to 200,000 complaints per annum. We're sitting now with 5,000 that we're expecting, 5 to 6,000. They are sitting with over 1,000 employees. So what I'm trying to say is, that is the trend. That's the trend. And the more people know, the more they complain. You see, if the office never was here, we most probably would never receive complaints. People just would have continued taking out the product, accepting it. And the more people know, the more they'll complain. So we're actually sitting with a catch-22, and we'll have to get that fine balance between it. And that's why, if we've got maybe one bigger type of ombud with different types of divisions, that would lead to the following. You've got your specialist on the short term, you've got your specialist on the investment, you've got your specialist on that division. And then you can just like relocate it to them. Thank you, and I'll give it over to Nazinto.
Thank you, Eugene. Members of this Honourable members are commenting, Chairperson, Honourable Chairperson. I just wanted to add on this dimension of the turnaround time that the way the Act is drafted at the moment, which is the Fines Act, there is a 6 week period which is allowed between the complainant and the person that's supposed to respond to the complaint. That period is 6 weeks. We stamp the complaint today. We don't do anything on it. The law wants us to give it over to them to work on it. And if by the end of 6 weeks that complaint is not resolved, then we start putting some work onto that complaint. But the age of the complaint runs as of the date that we've stamped it. So we also got those battles to deal with. And in some instances you find that in enforcing the 6 weeks rule, you might be saying to the person, all right, here's your complaint, you need to come back to me by a certain date. Then they come back to you 3 days before the date and say, I've just got a call to go overseas. Won't you give me another 2 or 3 weeks? You give them. And then you start working on the complaint after nine weeks now. Then you start investigating the complaint, etc., etc. So that's another difficulty that we have. And we can't just overlook the act because we're trying to chase turnaround time. You gotta at least, you know, comply with the act. The second thing is, you do have complaints that come into the office. And the moment you send it over to the other person to respond, they bring in lawyers, alright? And the moment you've got the lawyer coming in, then they take you blow by blow. Alright, I want you to explain line number so and so. They haven't given you the reply. I want you to come back and give me further documents before I can respond to this. I want you to give this. And the pain and the trouble we have to go through just to sort of, if I can call it, educate the lawyers themselves and say, listen, you don't have automatic right of representing your client in this forum. That on its own can take you any amount of time because you're going to talk to the person, they don't listen. They come back to you threatening with a high court interdict. Okay, any lawyer will tell you that you open your eyes when somebody threatens you with a high court interdict. It's something big. It's not like I'm going to report you to, you know, to my master of school or something. It's big. You've got to pay attention. Know what is the basis for you to lodge an interdict. We are explaining to you, go look at section so-and-so of the Fines Act. You honestly don't have a right of appearance in this. Then you move on to saying, all right, how do I get the right to represent the client? Well, you don't have, but you can simply advise your client outside the forum. Those things take time. And then eventually, they start helping their clients on the side. The truth of the matter is that the case is being defended. Okay? They will be taking you point by point on each and every correspondence that you send to them. Those matters we've got no control over. Alright? The third point is, now that our matters or decisions that the office makes are increasingly being taken on appeal, it demands that we be that much thorough. We can't do a, you know, quick fix type of approach on complaints. You've got to analyze the law. You've got to understand the products that you're dealing with. You've got to write a sound judgment to make it legally unassailable. All right? You've got to have that confidence that this is the correct answer to the problem. All right? So we have those challenges. And if you look at, you balance that with the flow of complaints that Mr. Alter has just spoken to you about, it becomes increasingly difficult for us to adhere to the 6 weeks or 6 months turnaround time. But we are working on it.
Chair, just on the point regarding the appeal, you are quite correct. We did express some degree of frustration in saying this is on appeal and this is on appeal and this is on appeal. It's a process. It's inbuilt into the Fines Act. And it's a legal process that anybody who is aggrieved by a decision of the Fines Ombud is entitled to apply for leave to appeal. And where we've refused, he's entitled to apply to the chair of the appeal board, who will then consider whether to grant or refuse such an appeal. Now, the board, the appeal board sits from time to time and then decides on the outcome of these appeals. I think except for one, which was recently finalized, the rest still sit in that process of appeal. And of course, the one I mentioned, the comedy judgment, it was taken on appeal. We had refused leave to appeal. There was an application, I think, to the chair of the board, and if I'm not correct, they then abandoned the appeal and said, we're paying off. So that was the one success, if I may call it, which then would have said that that's the final judgment that we have issued. If I may share with this committee an interesting model that the UK Ombuds has, and that's because there's been buy-in from the industry. And that we sit in this country, and you've heard us talk about voluntary ombuds, statutory ombuds like the PFA and the advice ombuds. What had happened in the UK is that they had voluntary ombuds all over, and they eventually got into what we call a statutory scheme. That statutory scheme had buy-in from the industry, in the sense that all the members of that scheme can't take the matter on appeal. They could take it on a review, if I'm not mistaken. But the consumer who is aggrieved can take it on appeal, which I thought was an interesting model. I'm sharing it with this committee, in the sense that the industry doesn't then keep taking you on appeal like appears to be happening. Now, the corollary to this is, if you look at the voluntary schemes, they say, oh, we're happy. We've got none of our matters being taken on appeal because the industry has bought into it. They would abide by the judgment of the particular voluntary scheme that they've become members of. Otherwise, they're not happy. They don't stay a member of the scheme. Move off. Now, that is a model that I thought was an idea I should share with this committee. I'm just going to jump a little. Regrettably, we hadn't come with our financial manager, Mr. Sinti Wabana. He is the person that would be able to answer a number of the questions relating to the financials, but I'm not going to shirk the question. I think Mr. Eugene Oakes has indicated that he could inform the committee, because we're all from the technical team dealing with the actual cases and the determinations. So we'll come to that. In terms of Mr. Asiya's question relating to short term, he said you said they are the main culprits, and what are you doing? What are your suggestions on how to resolve it? Ms. Bam and I have spoken some time, a few times, to say what we should do in relation to the short term industry is to call up a seminar, for example, and say to them, look, these are the difficulties. Do you guys know what you're supposed to do? And can you come to the party and tell us that you're going to do this? Now, that's one of the ways in which we start addressing what we call systemic problems. In these many addresses that we go, we actually address the systemic problems. And the one way to do it, and hopefully we may position it as part of our plan, that is the one way in which we could potentially address the problems in the short-term arena. But the other way, of course, is to do a well-reasoned judgment, which then goes out and says, this is the practice. Stop messing around. And we would do that from time to time. In fact, I think a number of our judgments going forward would be short-term industry judgments. I don't think Ms. Fubbs was then serious about the questions on the budget when she realized it wasn't in the millions. I'm not sure, but we can still explain. Yes. Eugene, would you like to take that one? In the meantime, Ms. Bam will handle one of the other issues. Go ahead, Ms. Fubbs.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. I just want to respond to Mr. Asiya's... It wasn't Mr. Asiya. It was Ms. Hobbs on the question of how do we plan to go about with this idea of consumer education. You're referring to mobilizing the media, etc. Are we going to be paying the media? How do we plan to go about it? And Mr. Pillay has already indicated that we actually, the function of educating consumers is not falling within our remit. We just feel that we have some, it just comes out of our sense of responsibility that we need to tell people about what we do. So from time to time, when there is that need for us to do, when we realize that we are in a position to do that, we then will ask the Financial Services Board for a budget to do some of those things, and they will give us the budget, and we go out there, we pay for the service, and we do it. Yes, you asked me. we're talking of mobilizing the media, are we going to be paying the media for this sort of service? In some instances, we do not pay. In some instances, we may be expected to pay. That's in short.
I think the call, and I think Ms. Bubsy is referring to the piece on consumer awareness, but the media, yes, the media should play a role. That's all we seek. We say to the media in general that they should play a role, that the media should be strong on the issue of consumer awareness, and that would help in a number of the instances that we of confusion that we highlighted, and that should come from the media itself.
Okay, I'm going to try and help where I possibly can. Keep in mind, I'm not the financial manager, but I know a few things about the office. If we go to page 60, the audit fees, I most probably won't be able to comment on it because I didn't go into the contract. I don't know why the fees are higher. The second one, accounting fees. Keep in mind, our previous general manager, financial manager, left. So what we had to do is we had to give. While we were searching for a new financial manager, we had to get somebody else to counsel for us on our financial management side. So that's why you've got the additional fees there. The cellular cost, I don't have a cell phone. I've got my own cell phone. I don't know what happened there. So I can't reiterate or say anything about it. The cleaning and general maintenance, I think what might have had an impact on it, keep in mind we also moved offices. We moved offices between the old and the new offices. And I think maybe some of the costs might have been incurred on the cleaning and general maintenance because we had the office layout, and then the office layout had to be rechanged because the first layout was incorrect. So now that also incurred extra costs. The consulting fees, I don't know, or what that would include specifically.
Can I make a suggestion on the financials? Can I recommend that take note of the specific questions that have been asked, and the committee be favored with a written response regarding, so that we get accurate responses that talk exactly directly to the questions raised. And if there are any other questions that arise out of this, I just recommend that that's what we do, so that
thank you, Chief.
we get direct and accurate answers.
Yes, thank you.
Just an addition. On what we are saying, Chairperson. When you read the PSMA, I'm trying to read it through my heart, Chairperson. Is that when you come for annual report, it's not only the manager for the day, for the future. It's not only for the management. It also comes with a financial statement. And I think the Section 36 of the PSMA, where two, that is the manager and the CFO, the manager for the finances, should come here and so that they can account. It's unacceptable to this committee, Chairperson, so that we can have this kind of response. I appreciate that. I wanted to emphasize that point, Chairperson. Thank you.
Okay, sure. It doesn't preclude members from asking questions in relation to the financials, but
certainly that is accepted. We didn't come with our financial manager. I mean, he's there. We could very easily have brought him along.
Yeah.
But I take the point that we would reply in writing. These things have go through an audit and committee. We now have external and internal auditors. So the office has grown, and the PFMA compliance requirements now demand, and if you look at the increase in the figures, it's possibly as a result of all of that.
Yeah, I think also partly because of what you mentioned earlier with regards to the confusion in the legislation. Because if you look at 23 on accountability of Section 23 of the Fires Act, it says that the Ombud is the accounting officer in respect of all funds received and all payments in respect. So we at some point we just expect answers from you, CFO or no CFO. But it always helps to have the person who actually deals with the figures, because unfortunately, the finance committee, there is no way you can deal with the other deliverables in the absence of the financial. Let's proceed.
Sorry, Chairman, to follow up and view the fact that it's going to be a written response on the trade and other receivables. Depending depending on what we would have been given, I would have also asked them about the rather high, you know, very high increase from the previous year. So what are these loans and receivables? And then, you know, an explanation on the accelerated increase.
If you could just note those questions that respond to those figures.
Okay.
Further responses? Sure.
I'm just looking to see what we've... Jurisdictional conundrum.
Mr. Singh's question?
On jurisdictional conundrum. David,
question. Okay. Okay.
Thank
Mr. Singh's question, and then Mr. Alcea, which question are you referring to, Mr. Alcea?
Captain Singh, I asked why are the liabilities accelerating, and what is the turnaround strategy to curb that? Yes, I was not responded to.
Okay, and can we then get responses to those, Mr. Singh's question? And those that you note for the written response, do say so that we also can note them, yeah.
We can, at the moment, just give you an idea of how the office is financed. The office is financed through levies that are collected by the Financial Services Board, okay? And then they're handed over to the Fiesombus office. So what happens is that from time to time, when the Fiesombus office needs money, they will get it from the Financial Services Board, and it's noted as a loan from the Financial Services Board. It's not from any other external partner. It's not like a company or a bank or something. It's just money that is passed by the Financial Services Board to us before the levies are fully collected and accounted for. They note it in our books as loans. It's not like we're going around borrowing money from other people.
In any event, the point that has been made is that these will be done in written form, because once Mr. Simpiwa Bana sees these, he will have very clean and clear answers to them.
Okay. Further responses?
Thank you, Chair. I just want to touch back on the potential single ombud, but first, before even going there, again, the issue of the... What our suggestion is, other than complaining about the short-term insurance issues, I think first thing to very importantly to mention is you have the short-term insurance ombud already in place. He's given recognition in terms of the Financial Services Ombud Schemes Act. So there are certain areas that we don't have jurisdiction on, and we've got to be careful about. In all honesty, sometimes we do try and get as close to the line as we possibly can, but there's some areas we don't have jurisdiction on, and there are limits in that respect. That's the first thing. The second part, and it relates to the question as to how we prioritize cases, and I think one thing that we probably very much see ourselves is trying to look at the bigger picture. In other words, we're not just specializing in short-term or long-term ombud, we're trying to look at broader systemic issues, and the ombud raised the issue of these unlawful deductions that take place from people's salary, and we're looking at that as we're spending, I can assure this committee, quite a considerable amount of time in investigating that prior to possibly coming out with a determination. And we have, there's another matter which I prefer not to sort of even touch on at this stage, which is we also see as a much broader systemic issue, and I think when it does come out, the implications will be fairly large. But we try and look at it from a much broader issue. So whilst the amount, and then the second issue I'm talking about, the amounts are not huge by financial services standards, but the implications to the amount to a huge number of consumers are very, very large. Now, the reason I'm talking about, the reason I bring in the fact that we look at it from a much broader issue is one of my reasons for saying, or one of the reasons for saying there needs to be a single sort of entry structure that has the ability to oversee it in the financial services industry in its entirety, instead of having separate areas that have separate jurisdiction. Yes, I mean, there is a degree of interaction between ourselves and the various other ombuds within the industry, and we are certainly making an effort to increase that interaction. We certainly see each other, and I think there's a degree of common ground, if I can say. But at the same time, just dealing with the complaints at ground level, I've got to be very careful that, and I've had numerous instances in my desk where I would like to raise strategic issues. I would like to, and I do question financial services providers. However, my authority, or the authority of the office, to actually seriously look at some of those issues, we've got to be careful of how, I mean, Sam talked very much about the field procedure and whatever else, and we get challenged on every single point that we do. So if I start or trying to look at a case where I'm overstepping my jurisdiction, even though I know these issues that I want to raise, I'm slightly hesitant on doing it, because I know if we make a decision and it goes to appeal, I'm not saying we're not scared to raise those issues, but we also need to be careful of how we raise it. And that's what, why I'm raising the issue of possibly a single point of entry which has overriding authority. The problem is, whilst you have a recognition of the various schemes which you do have, there's not one body that has overriding jurisdiction. And I clearly said in my initial talk that there are areas in a particular case which can have both advice and product queries, which could essentially fall within the jurisdiction to ombuds. Trying to write an actual judgment where you want to discuss both areas when two separate bodies have jurisdiction is a difficult task at best. And it, I must be honest, those complaints are difficult to deal with because we cannot raise those issues. And with the level of one, you've got, as I said, there's two issues. You've got consumer confusion. That is clear. I mean, I can show the committee the letters. But the second issue, it makes our task a little bit more difficult when I've got to spend time trying to work out which party has jurisdiction. If we have one single point with overriding authority, I'm not saying dismantle the current existing structures. That's not necessarily what I would personally suggest. But certainly someone who says, right, if we receive a specific complaint that is, let's say short-term, which would normally have fallen completely within the jurisdiction short-term ombuds, if we feel potentially that area needs to be looked at, then let's say we have the authority to actually pull that and say, right, we want to make an issue that we want to actually raise those issues. Currently, we might not have because it might not fall in our jurisdiction. There are certain perceived perceptions that the industry ombuds may not be impartial. There may be issues around that as well. But certainly, I think from our side, working with people within the industry. Thank you.
Okay, are there any outstanding questions in the previous page so I could move on?
Mr. Singh asked a question on, no, it wasn't prioritization. There are two questions of spending. It's about those replacement values and market values and retail values. And the other one is on identity numbers and the use thereof by people unauthorized to do so. On that short-term insurance and the values, we do come across problems, but I must say very seldom where people will be saying, okay, what is market value? What is retail value? What is replacement value, etc.? The difference is not that much if we're talking solely on the basis of cars. And we feel that these are the things that the short-term industry itself should take responsibility for and educate its members and ensure that people understand what they get into, because that is the time that one has the opportunity to ask all these questions. You don't want to know when you lodge a claim that, sorry, we actually had insured you for X amount, X value, replacement or whatever. The question is, you get to understand what you are being sold and buy into a product knowingly. So I would say it again rests at the door of the short-term insurance people to ensure that they meet the challenge to educate people about the differences between all these values. The other thing was a question of the use of identity numbers. We don't really have that as such, except in the realm of unauthorized policies, etc., etc. What we were going to suggest is that if one has a problem like that, and there's listing involved in the credit bureau for debts that people did not pay, then you've got two offices that you could probably contact. That's the National Credit Regulator or the Credit Information Ombudsman. They will, between the two of them, they will help you with that.
the outstanding issue, apart from the financial issues, as I see them, the committee can call if we've missed something out, was again Mr. Singh's comment relating to radio stations and the use thereof. Of course, we'd use those vehicles whenever possible, but it's subject to the constraints that I've mentioned earlier on. And a very interesting question which Mr. Singh raised was, how do you prioritize dealing with complaints? It's in terms of pecking order, if I may call it, we have an assessment area called case assessment, case administration. If they within that area can clean up or clear up what is not meant for us, what can be resolved with a quick letter to the provider concerned, they would do so. So that's one area of filtering that takes place. When it hits the case manager, again, it's the last complaint or the complaint that came earliest should be dealt with first. So that's one area of priority. But there's another strategy, if I may put it, that is utilized. And that is to handle systemic issues. I can give you one example. When we just started office, there was a practice where bondholders, people, if you borrowed money from the bank, they simply said you must take out your insurance with that particular provider through this particular intermediary. It's what we call no free choice. You have no free choice. And they relied on a section of the Short-Term Insurance Act. And the Fires Act was squarely in their faces. And they ignored it. Now, we took a strategic view. We were getting 10, 20, 30 complaints like that. And each time we gave it to them, they would say, okay, fine, we'll give that person free choice. And we say, why are you giving that person free choice? Because it's come from the Fires Ombuds office. We must find a strategy to rule. And in the one case that was not settled, and if a case is not settled, that's the only time we can rule. We were waiting for the opportunity to rule. And when we did, I think we had actually resolved that issue, that systemic issue of consumers not being able to have free choice. Now, that's where we take strategies. And David Davidson mentioned one where he said, I don't want to tell this committee about it because it is at a sensitive stage of investigation where we want to rule on another systemic issue which hopefully will clear up another problem. Similarly, I mentioned that the time is not yet ripe, but we may do a determination on unauthorized policies, which hopefully will stop that and nip it in the bud. That would reduce or start reducing the various complaints that come in those areas because the industry then says, oh, there's a determination. We must now behave. We must understand that this is the benchmark that we must be using. So if one talks about prioritizing and strategy, that's what we use as a general rule. There are some cases that have wide impact. One case would solve a whole plethora of problems because it's a systemic issue. So that's how we deal with those kinds of things. I hope I've answered that question. Chair, I'm not sure if there are any others. If the committee members feel that there's anything that we've missed out.
Questions have not been addressed. Members feel that their questions have not been addressed. They can always raise them again. I now have Mr. Mguni, Mr. Johnson, and Mr. Mbili. Also, in relation to your response to... in relation to your response on consumer education, on page 62 of your operational review against goals, you mention that the office has steadily increased its public profile through proactive interaction with the print, electronic, and internet media. At the bottom, you mentioned that the profile of the ombudsman has been managed by positioning him as a spokesperson of choice on matters affecting consumers of financial services. In the reporting period, media coverage worth an estimated $7.2 million was generated. I mean, if you could also explain that to us when you respond to the other questions. I'll take Mr. Mguni after this one, and Mr. Johnson and Mr. Mguni.
Thanks, Jim. I just want to comment that on the issue of the jurisdiction conundrum, I think it's a key issue that the committee has to deal with, and also I think the office of the ombudsman and the maximum press give us also some suggestions of what is the best solution to towards this overlapping of jurisdictions. My question, Chair, is related to that. On your strategic plan, if I may call it a strategic plan, the Tuhla Foundation document on page 4, that's where you reckon that if perhaps the Office of the Ombudsman could be, of the Ombuds could be a separate entity, not dependent on FSB or government, be not independent, it might work better, because you're citing where there could be tensions between FSB or the minister or the government. If you can just comment on that, how would you foresee yourself functioning as an independent entity? My second question here is on the issue of compliance officers misleading or giving wrong information to brokers. What action have you taken in as far as these compliance officers are concerned, or what do you foresee would be the solution to this problem? Should they also go the fit and proper testing as like service providers? And also on the issue of products that some actuaries do not even understand. What could be the remedy to the situation? And my last question here is on the issue of Forex dealings. That they constitute only 2% of all the complaints. But how many Forex dealings have you dealt with? Because, you know, like this leadership, the guard services. Are there any other agents that you have dealt with, and how much money was involved in it? Thanks, Chair.
Okay.
Let's
take
charge.
Thanks, Chair. I see a revolution here in this team. Ngori, when he has to talk, he's going to get his glasses lowered, you see. Typically intellectual. You look. Comrade Joel, I don't think, I thought you were going to intervene here, that she represented us. I would have imagined, you know, Judge Mufenagan listening, you know. That is adding, you know, almost.
That she ends the whole budget of FIRES.
Okay, let's congratulate FIRES in its short period of time on the work that it is doing. Also, the format of the report itself, I think it should also be very congratulated. I would imagine even other departments or agencies of government, if they were to follow, you know, the style wherein the report, there is also included the synopsis of, you know, whatever you call it, task plan or program, you know, that the report is actually reporting on. I think it's very good. It makes life easy for you to refer almost without having to get another document somewhere else. Be that as it may, Chair, very quick questions. On the extent in which success we can be able to talk about, the page 6 of the ombuds, you know, refers to the extent in which, you know, successes have been raised, which is commendable. What I'm keen on are the values of those success stories in rands and cents. You have split those in accordance with provinces and so on. I would be keen equally to get a sense of the value in rands and cents. You did allude to the 2% as they relate to the foreign activities that we have been able to catch. Now, in line with this, equally is another question that we constantly ask FSB about the extent in which they have been able to succeed in their work line of duty together with FICA. And underlying this question equally is the relationship you have as the Ombuds Office with all these other agencies that are doing similar type of work. I'm a strong believer that for as long as we work in silos, we're not going to be seeing much of impact of what we are doing. To understand, such relationships must be established to a point where, you know, such impacts must be noted. So that's the first one. So the second one, I would urge maybe, you know, the office to seriously think out of the box from today onwards. Chair, we have been raising a question countless with FSB on reaching out and establishing itself in other regions. I would imagine a scenario wherein FSB and the Ombuds Office establishing themselves as a joint office in other provinces, so that we don't find a situation where people have to call all the time. I don't know how many people go in person to your office. You only have one office, right? I would imagine you are also situated somewhere in some nice plush suburb, somewhere in Pretoria. To an extent, a question for me is, you see, what the kind of people you are dealing with here are the people who are not sophisticated. You are correctly pointing that one yourself. So you don't really are going to get enough of, you know, what's the word in English here? Ukoneliseka, if you understand what I'm talking about. Kana beza teta kunye nawe over the line. Wherein the kind of satisfaction, that's the English word I was looking for, it's my fourth language. Now, sir, I don't know how we want to deal with this one out of this meeting from moving forward. But this is something that we've been talking about all the time, as to how best do we implement it this time around, so that next time we come to this committee, we talk about program that works towards implementation of having to have those offices elsewhere, so that you don't get people to... The last one, Chair, on the pension fund, which is more on the finances. I just saw a serious gap moving from 206 to 207 on the pension fund contribution. I can't remember the actual figures.
Page 58, the retirement benefits.
Exactly.
From 176, 152 in 2006 to 561, 369.
If you could be clarified on that, as you, and the also related issue on the finances again, the increase in terms of income, just to cite but one, of course we can't deal with the rest, from the Ombuds Office or the Ombuds person itself, from 909 to 1.2 million. Just in 1 year.
Page again.
Same page. Page 57, sorry. Year end 31st March 2006 to year end 2007. There was almost a 33% somewhere there, you know, a lip by the Ombuds from, I mean, his income. Without really getting into the details of other, you know, other personnel in terms of income. It would also be clarified on that, whether is that also consistent with the rest of the other staff, and what are the basis of that, you know, serious leap from 909 to 1 million to 17. We're talking millions this time, Conor John.
Okay. And perhaps in relation to the other question that Mr. Johnson asked relating to the retirement benefits. What I was trying to reconcile is the issue of the increase in personnel, because I would have imagined that the two should more or less be tied to each other. Personnel only increased from about 5 million to 6.6, and yet retirement benefits increased from 176 to 561. I think it's one of those that perhaps would be better explained by the CFO, but just to raise it so that you take note of it.
It's just a small one.
I hope you're not asking another question because I've recognized Mr. Mbidi.
Oh, no. Then yeah. I thought you were passing it over, Chairperson.
No. I was just adding to the question Mr. Johnson asked about the increase from 176 to 568 and relating it to the increase in personnel costs. Okay. I'll give you an opportunity. I've recognized Mr. Mbidi.
Thanks, Chair. Thanks for a wonderful presentation. Thanks to Ms. Bam. Ms. Rantlin. Ms. Bam for yet another enlightening kind of input in this regard. I want to take an issue of what is normally called in substances trade agreement, if you like, the issue of a fine print. Fine print, see this little small word, the bottom there, which undoubtedly most of us, me included, we don't. There's a lot of things there we don't bother to go through, to interrogate them. Wouldn't be, or what can be done to get rid of that fine print? Because at the end of the day, it forms the part of the contract. It forms the nature, and you find that most of the controversial issues are written in that fine print. I move from the premise that is deliberate, that argument. What can be done to get rid of that fine print? Linked to that, Chair, you have a situation where supposedly a consumer did see something out of that fine print eventually, and he wants to get out of that contract. He wants to remember, you said I was not given the option of the alternative. Now I've realized that there is something out of that fine print that doesn't suit me. I want to get out of that contract. More especially on the insurance issue, then I identify an alternative. And the financial institution linked with these insurance people, oh my God, I can tell you, they will make your life hell to get out of that. What can be done there? The last one, Chair, the very last one for me, it will be the issue of leader card. Sounds like a very complicated matter. It has not been resolved. Or has it? It has not been resolved. It has not been complicated. It has not been completed. To me, that talks to the issue of capacity. The capacity on complicated investigation. Can you share your experience? Do you have enough capacity in terms of dealing with this, and if you can take the committee to your confidence, when do we see finally the close on this matter? I'm talking specifically about the legal matter. Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Fanta, you said you had a small one because this is the last.
It relates to the response that we received, Chairperson, in the first round. And thank you for your lenience here. It's the point about the debt, you know, the debits, the stop orders, etc., and the fraud that, you know, was quite prevalent in that case, and people not being aware of this. And I think the comment from yourselves was that, you know, unfortunately, you know, we can only do so much, and these people move around in the industry quite often. You know, they are dismissed, if you like, from a particular company. They created an impression that they may well not have been prosecuted. Now, I understand that you are not a prosecuting authority, but my question or perhaps comment would be, is there no way that you could strengthen some kind of relationship with a prosecuting authority to just ensure or alert that such people should in fact face a much bigger penalty other than dismissal?
Okay. Thank you, Chair. May I start, Chair, with your question? And this was in relation to picking up what was said in the operational review against Gold, page 62 of the report. What we do is employ a public relations company, and that's under marketing and strategy. Now, public relations companies generally have a method, and that's an internationally recognized method. It's shared with the office on a monthly basis as to what the value is of the publicity that has been done for the office, be it by way of a reportage as a result of a determination done, be it as a result of my having spoken on Summit Television or Kaya FM or Radio Lotus or whatever. They would then do a value to it. And the value then, some companies say, we multiply that by 7. The company we use says, no, we take a conservative and we multiply it by 3. For example, when we release the annual report, they send us a report saying the value of the publicity you received is 1.62 million or something like that. And they took articles in the Personal Finance and said, if you advertise in the Personal Finance, this is what you would have had to pay. If you advertise in Radio Lotus, this is what you would have paid. If you went on Summit, we had interviews on CNBC Africa and things like that. So that is how that is computed. Then to get on to the question which I think Mr. Nguni raised on the key issue relating to jurisdictional conundrums and what is the best suggestion. There was a suggestion that came from this committee about getting everybody together and seeing how best we could go forward in creating a single scheme which is independent and doesn't have to answer other than perhaps to a parliamentary committee. For me, the issue of independence is a very strong one. It's strong, and that's why we said it in our strategic plan. It's strong because you can be truly independent if you are not reporting to anyone other than the voice of the people, as it were, and that, for me, is really parliament. And that's what we said in our strategic plan, and hopefully, if the policymakers see it first after debate, they would say, well, why not? Why should it not? We're not talking about not being governed and just being a loose cannon. We're talking about reportability, but reportability in a particular syndrome, in a particular syntax. And the syntax that I refer to is typically how our best reported should really be to Parliament. On the issue, again from Mr. Mguni, compliance officers giving wrong information and not doing their work properly, they have to be fit and proper, according to the FS, the FISE Act. The custodian of their conduct is really the Financial Services Board. Our function is to say to the Financial Services Board, and they get every determination in terms of the Act, we send a determination which they would read, and then they would see whether there's any action to be taken. And we have specifically said, we in determinations, that we trust the Financial Services Board will take the necessary action. And I'm sure they would take whatever action is necessary should a compliance officer have not conducted himself in an acceptable manner. In fact, the Fines Act, I think in Section 20, says that if the compliance officer is an accountant, I think there could be disbarring provisions. But I think they've now extended that in terms of a raft of amendments that's coming through Parliament, and it might already be before this committee, where if any compliance officer could be subject to disbarment. So, again, in growing this jurisprudence and this legislation, the loose areas, I hope, are being tied up. I want to deal with questions that I, and there may be others that my colleagues will look at. Mr. Johnson, thanks for the laudatory comments, both from yourselves and other members of this committee. If one talks about values, you would have noticed that we put up a slide saying that the value, if one wants to quantify it, of the determinations and monies returned to the consumers was 10 million in the year that has passed, 10.069 million. There was a slide for that effect. That is the value that we put by way of determinations and settlements back in the hands of the consumers.
I think just as Yomar has said, it's difficult to actually put an exact quantifiable figure, and the exact reason for that is again, as Yomar said, the effect of the judgment is much broader. I had a very interesting comment about a month or two back from basically one of the compliance officers at one of the major banks, as it turned out, and we were talking about the complaints coming to officers, and basically what she said to me, she said, you don't actually even want to see some of the complaints that we see at times. In other words, those complaints don't even reach your office. We sort them out then and there because we get them and we sort them out. The reason they get them and they sort them out is because they don't want to come into office. So we can't even, you know, those figures are, or those complaints, there's a huge volume of complaints that are being resolved directly now with the financial institution purely because this office actually exists. And we can't quantify. We definitely know there's an impact out there. We've seen it from just chatting to the interaction that occurred with the institution. So, and I think that's, you know, whilst the figure shows 10 odd million, it doesn't look like a huge amount of money. But the actual impact is far greater, and we want to actually see that continuing. There was an interesting question raised about, you know, what would be the remedy in respect of products that are not properly understood. And I think, and really, we're talking to the product complexity act there. We have, and I have in certain presentations, I've made, actually raised that issue. And it's certainly something I think over time I would personally like to see raised a lot stronger. I quite agree with the comment made that, you know, there's a lot of small print in some of these things. Really, at the end of the day, that small print is often what excludes the payout of a claim. And you only become aware of it when you see when there's actually a claim search. I can just talk about one of the basic examples. If one takes certain types of life cover per se, the various types of life cover, in terms of, let's just take some sort of dread disease cover, there are so many different variations of this type of product that, and it could be a small nuance, which means that you aren't paid out. And those are questions we are going to start asking, and already starting to ask, as to whether, should there not be a single product? And look, one doesn't want to dictate to the marketplace and say, look, these are the type of products you must create. That would be incorrect. However, the question's got to be asked when you've got 40 or 50 different types of similar products from one product supplier, all with different sort of subtleties, whether really that, with a lot of fine print, and whether that's really an appropriate way to actually go and deal with that. And I totally agree with, and I think that's an area we're going to have to look at in time. And again, it goes back to having that overall ability to look at, because those are the product providers, bear in mind, provide those products. In a lot of instances, we might, not in all, in some instances, we might not have jurisdiction to actually look at those and actually specifically raise those questions. I do have cases in my office which specifically raise those type of issues. And the question is whether, also the question is whether that particular product is actually fair when you look at it in terms of the actual exclusion clause. Because there are specific, in other words, clients got a specific claim that they've suffered quite a serious loss, cancer. In one particular case I'm looking at it,
but however, the actual payout is comparatively small because, I'll give you an example, in this particular case, the question was the severity of the cancer. What I, as a layperson, see is particularly, or it's quite a serious case. In this case, the woman suffered a double mastectomy. She had to have because she had, whereas the insurance company, because it's interpreted by the chief medical officer, don't see it as a major risk. It's not life-threatening to them. Only payout, I think, was 5% of the actual amount she was actually covered for. I had serious questions around that particular case. But again, I need to be careful around my jurisdiction.
Okay. I just want to quickly say something else. Regarding the question on the percentage of settlements versus the rand value, if we go to page 22 in the annual report, you'll see on the left-hand side we've actually got growth in volumes, and then we've got on the right-hand side quantifiable settlements and determinations. So you'll see on the left-hand side you'll find that there were 15 determinations written, and on the right-hand side you'll see the impact of the determinations just on those 15, which is nearly 3 million, which is approximately 30%, but if you take 15 of the total settlements, it's not even that amount. So what we're saying is that we can't just work on the figure. And just like in economics, we'll find that there's a multiplier effect. There's a multiplier effect. If the government decides that they're going to curb or they're going to expand an expansion of the country, or it's going to be an expensive view, they can't say what the impact would be if the government might put in 3 to 5 billion then into the market. It's got a multiplier effect over the long term. Then, regarding the issue of, yes, complexities of products, what's funny is I went to a seminar, I think it was 2 years ago, they said that South Africa and Australia's got most probably the most complex insurance products in the world. And I don't know why it is. You must understand that insurance companies don't just think out these products. What's interesting is that a lot of these markets are driven by the people that want the product. So you'll find that the market out there, let's say for instance, you're sitting with South Africa, you've got two diverse differences top of the market. You'll find people that like very complex, and then you've got people that don't have those complex products. But what would happen is that you'll find that you get a medical aid. This is an example. Now a person says, but why don't we would like to have that additional benefit of going to a gym. And our market, we just love all the bells and whistles. And that when you start adding, with all these bells and whistles, you're starting to get a very complex market. And I also think on the one side, we can't just over-govern them because it's a free market, but we also need to say, well, can't they just try and simplify the market a bit more for the average person? Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. There was a question about working in silos. How do we relate to other state agencies? Because Mr. Johnson felt that it might not really help us to work in silos. And he mentioned institutions like FITA, for example. How do we relate to one of those? I can say that someone out there has realized that it doesn't really help to work in silos. And there has been, what is still underway, a symposium that was organized by the Minister of Finance, where most of these state agencies, FICA, CIPRO, SARS, the Reserve Bank, you know, FIRES Ombud, FSB, all coming together to sort of find some basis of working together for the benefit, of course, of strengthening our markets and to ensure that our consumers are adequately protected. So that work is still underway. Thank you.
On the question, again, from Mr. Johnson, that we should start to seriously think out of the box and that certain suggestions were made to the Financial Services Board. Now, remember, we are operating on the basis, although we're in the Act, where we report to the Financial Services Board. And if one wants to give one's views on establishing offices in other regions, of course, there are budgetary implications involved in that. That's the one issue. But this committee would have heard us say that we already have, if I may put it bluntly, one challenge on our hands, and that is the conundrums around jurisdiction. And we have grappled and come up with suggestions on how we believe there could be some kind of joining up, if I may call it, of these various institutions, which may eventually lead to lesser costs overall anyway, because if you look at the budgets of each of these institutions, they are fairly substantial. It could add up to a fairly substantial budget. Hopefully, if that is done, then the issue of regional offices could become a reality, because you've cleared the area of the confusion. You have the offices dealing with all issues, and then to reach out to the other regions would be a natural development, if I may call it, of that process. That is my sense and take on it. I know that the other question Mr. Johnson asked was relating to finances, but let me attempt an answer to the question relating to my own salary. I was appointed on the 1st of August 2003. I am not sure then what the salary was, but I think it would have been about 800 and some change. My paymaster is the Financial Services Board. The board decides on reviews from time to time in relation to the salary of the ombud. Now, if you take the period of time between my appointment 2003 to now, I think we're in the fourth year. In the fourth year, the fourth year in which I'm in this business of being the vice ombud. I think I can't answer for how the board decided to review, and I think it was a review of my salary at some stage, and maybe I was missed out in the process prior thereto. I can't answer for that. All I can say is, I think in the lead up from the 1st of August 2003 to now, it would have been some consideration of both annual reviews and a review based on the workload of the ombudsman. I can say quite categorically that I have no say in that. I have had no say in that. But if one wants to put it in the perspective of other public entities and state corporations, I don't know if this committee has seen a Sunday Times article which put out the salaries of CEOs in public entities. Mine was last chair. It was actually the smallest. But if the committee wants an answer, then I think it has to be posed to the ACARS department of the FSB. I think that typically is where the question should be posed.
That is why it helps to have the CFO so that you don't respond to some of these questions.
and insofar as the question relating to pension fund contribution, that's a relevant question. Again, would Mr. Johnson and the committee be happy that I get some leeway to put a formal answer? Yes. I think the other two questions my colleagues can take. There was one from Mr. Mbili to Ms. Bam specifically. It was to Ms. Bam specifically. And then to Mr. Davidson relating to Lidegaard.
Can we have quick responses to those?
But no, that's the interest, yes, yeah.
I think no. Members, don't do this. We're just about to end. I can see that members are getting impatient. Can we
respond to the last two questions.
Okay, thank you, Chair. Thank you, members. I just wanted to respond to the fine print question on financial products. It's not the first time that we hear that people are frustrated about fine print, because, most importantly, some of the real issues that will be coming up when you are frustrated will be pointed towards those fine prints, that it is actually contained there, you should have seen it. We have had occasion to pronounce in the context of doing our work, and we would be pointing out to the provider concerned that, look, this in fact was too small. We actually measure the print and we say, it is, you know, this is equivalent to this, and yet the Fines Act wants you to write in this size print. And we're talking only in the context of the work that we do. So we will point out to the providers now and again when we have occasion to say to them, look, that this fine print is actually violating what the Fines Act requires. The print should be a certain size. Insofar as working on, you know, eradicating the fine print totally, it's up to the industry to do that. We can only pronounce it in the context of handling a complaint. Remember, we would not go out and pronounce on anything unless there is a complaint and we have an opportunity to deal with a particular issue that is evident on the complaint. Thank you.
Okay, just, in terms of the Leaguard issue, we've had 7 determinations already. There are still a number of complaints in the office. What we did to technically is put some of those complaints on hold because the main Leaguard matter, which is the Comey versus Ewing matter, was scheduled for an appeal hearing. And what we were hoping is to get some clarification from the appeal board as to whether our thinking was actually right in that process, proceeding with the other one. What subsequently happened with that matter is it was actually in fact settled. The complainant was paid out, it appears. So what we've now got to do is actually proceed with the rest of those matters and proceed to determination. There's also, I think, an issue of the criminal investigations which now appear to be going forward. We haven't really, obviously, been, as not a prosecuting authority, we've touched on those to a certain degree, and I think Ms. Bam has had some meetings in that respect, but we haven't really been involved in it, not being a prosecuting authority, we haven't really been involved in that, but we supposedly understand that it's actually proceeding now, that there are prosecutions that are going forward, or certain investigations going forward in order to investigate that matter. I think in terms of, if I want to touch quickly on fine print again, very important to you, and one thing we look at very closely, is that in terms of even if it's fine print, in fact, those fine print issues have been disclosed to the person that the product has been sold to by the financial advisor, and that's very important. Thank you.
I think there was one last question. It's probably not yet to hear the answer, but it was her question on what have we done in relation to prosecutions. Now, she understood and positioned that we are not the prosecuting authorities, but we've actually held meetings with the National Prosecuting Authority where we've told them these are difficulties.
We did it at that. Thank you very much. It really has been useful engaging with yourselves, and we look forward to further engagement. And also the issue of the confusion, I think we need to take that one forward. The issue of legislation, the committee, you know, shares your frustrations, and I would imagine it would make life much easier, both for our, what would that be? Yeah, but thank you very much. We look forward to further engagement, and we will be in touch, and we look forward also to receiving written responses to questions related to the financial. Before we adjourn, the committee has a very quick matter to deal with, but today being our last day in Parliament, we have sent an invitation to everybody that is in the room for a sit-down lunch at the Max building. This invitation is to everyone that is here at the time of the extension of the invitation. So we are all invited at Max building. We'll just walk across to the other building and have lunch sitting down and not standing on our feet like we normally have, we do. But also to say that we have circulated the
We have circulated the program for the committee for next year. Not cast in stone, but this committee is required to adopt this before we part. But we will then make the necessary adjustments when we meet at our strategic planning workshop. But for submission purposes, I would just like to request that the committee adopt the program. Mr. Billy agrees, seconded by Mr. Singh. Thank you. The program is hereby adopted.
It is just a question of clarity for me on the previous matter, on the one which we were deliberating on the annual report, on a technical point. The exercise was whether it wanted to be for us to adopt it or not. The report, the annual report of the fire zone.
But it's not for adoption. The annual report is an accounting process for all state entities and departments to submit to the report and for portfolio committees to then report to Parliament on. Thank you very much. Then the invitation sent at Mark Building. We'll meet there. No, you can't refuse. No.